Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Pellett Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
Welcome to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdoch Murders, Money and Mystery. We are here for our daily recap of what's going on in the Murdoch murder trial. And we want to start this podcast off, this Friday off, with breaking news that we wanted to share with you about the trial. And I'm going to let our legal analyst, South Carolina's former Attorney General, Charlie Condon. He's here with us, as is our executive producer, Drew Tripp, and master controls and production back there, Max Harrison. Charlie, tell me what we've learned.
Hard news. I can confirm from a very reliable source on the defense team that they focus grouped the defense that they're going to be using, that the killing or the murdering of the defendant's son and wife, that jurors would find that just really hard to believe when you put the motivation being financial crimes. It's central to their defense in light of the focus group, as I understand it. And hard news here. In other words, this issue has been tested, and it's tested well, very well for the defense. And they're using it effectively during this trial. It's been their theme, and no reason they're using it, because they know that through the focus group, mm-hmm. that people have a really, really hard time believing that someone who has money trouble would be motivated then to kill his wife and his son. So that's the hard news that I have, and just wanted to share it with you.
I'm so glad you did, because it's something that has been running, I think, kind of running over in all of our minds, is how is the defense keeping up this this play, basically, mm-hmm. that, you know, the defendant is going to be found, you know, in their mind, not guilty, because this kind of crime, he would never do it. I mean, I think that's what we hear over and over again.
Right.
It's unthinkable mm-hmm. that a man who's been to all the baseball games, just literally that weekend, you know, they were together, right?
Yeah, and that day
he was messing around on the truck, mm-hmm. right, with his son. There mm-hmm. was always this perception of a loving atmosphere. So I guess when the defense, and we don't know how the defense put it to the focus group necessarily, but they presented a loving father who up until literally minutes, if less than an hour before they died, was treating his family like loved ones.
Yeah, and there's no evidence of separation, right, or fights. The evidence thus far, and of course we're early in this trial, mm-hmm. but the evidence thus far is that it was a happy family. Wouldn't you say? That's the evidence.
And that's what the focus group agreed to.
Well, as I understand, it was tested with the focus group. Would you have issues with convicting somebody of murder of the person's son and daughter, I mean son and a wife, based upon the motivation that he had horrible money troubles? Mm-hmm. And the focus group said, I would have real issues convicting someone based upon that motivation. And, you know, as I talk to folks about this, that is one question that does repeat itself. Well, what's the motivation here? Then you say, well, the state's theory is it's the white collar, as I've talked about, turning into blood red collar because of the financial crimes, turning into horrible violent crimes, horrible murders. It a lot of people do have questions as to how that could possibly be. And it is true. If you start thinking about our human experience, we all at times have had issues with money or this or that. And even if you have extreme financial issues, it is hard to imagine, isn't it?
Doing something that violent.
Mm-hmm. To
and that sounds like that's going to be a big part
family.
Of the defense.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever used a focus group like
that? I have not. I've not been involved with one. It's very common in the legal profession, particularly on what one would call high value cases on the civil side. And of course, this is an important case on the defense side. So it would make sense to have done it, but I had read that there was possibility of this, but I can now confirm that in fact it did happen and it tested. The news here is that it tested the highest, the best.
In the defense's favor.
In the defense favor. And
wow.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, the confirmation was that it was focus group and the clear information to me was this was the top one that they feel would be the most effective. And we've heard it, I mean, from day one, haven't we? That is there any you're saying? And
yeah,
you know,
I agree.
And you notice how Judge Newman shut down the ludicrous argument because he's probably tired of hearing it, right?
Well,
just want to share the hard news here and we can move on to some other great topics.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for doing that. And I want to go to the other flip side of this. We're about to hear a clip from a young man named Tony Satterfield. And I say this is the flip side because Tony Satterfield is one of Alec Murdoch's financial victims. And we know this because Alec Murdoch has already put a confession of judgment towards this case of $4.3 million in the Satterfield case. This is the late housekeeper of Murdoch who fell. It was in a trip and fall incident at his home. And through insurance settlements that he had worked, her boys were supposed to receive up to $4.3 million, and they didn't receive a cent. Listen to when he comes up to testify. He's testifying to try and get the financial crimes included in this jury trial. Right now, this is without a jury. Listen to Tony.
Did he tell you that they had already gotten a settlement for $505,000?
No.
Did he tell you that they had already gotten a settlement for $3.8 million?
No.
Had he ever told you that there was an umbrella policy for $5 million?
No.
Did he ever mention to you anything about forge?
No.
Did he mention anything to you about structuring any settlement?
No.
Did you give him permission to steal your money?
No.
This is a case that we've been following for a long time. We've done podcast episodes on this. To hear the Tony Satterfield, 33 years old, get up there. He was sitting right in front of me right before he stood up. And when he came back down, the sled agents were patting him on the back. He got a lot of hand, mm-hmm. you know, got his hand shook a few times by these guys. And got, you know, Eric Bland put his arm around him and said, well done. He was so nervous, he said, but he carried through with it. How effective do you think this Tony Satterfield is? Or how damaging.
How much time do we have? I had to go over to meet the person because, my firm, we handle cases on the same type basis. These contingency fee cases that we have large settlements, small settlements. And the idea that, gosh, I mean, where do I begin? This is his housekeeper's son that he would know intimately, right?
Housekeeper of 20 years, mind you.
Yes, and so this lawyer, and it's such a black mark on our profession. I was just really angry hearing it because he not only secretly settles these cases without the client knowing, and it takes two other people to be part of this really.
Dastardly
I would have
scheme,
to. This
yeah.
horrible agreement, and so he steals these funds that. This very sympathetic person needs this money after losing his mother. It was, I can't think of anything worse that a lawyer could do other than killing somebody.
Right.
But interesting evidentiary question here, just so you'll maybe think about this. I anticipated this on Monday. We have this rule 403 that any evidence that the prejudicial effect outweighs the probative value, that it proves a point. So the state wants to use this to prove motive. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Judge Newman says, this is so horrible that the prejudicial effect, and I think I'd have a hard time disagreeing with this, actually, just having heard this testimony. It is so horrible what happened here. I do think that the jurors are likely to go past the what it's used for, which is simply to prove, not simply, but it's an important issue to prove motive, to be so angry with this defendant.
To punish the judge, him for that.
For this, yeah, the judge liable to exclude it. So we'll see what happens on Monday.
Do you think that could be the bridge to link it all together, the bridge to get them across that threshold of there's no way, even with financial troubles, there's no way that he could go out and murder his wife and son? Do you think the idea that he could...
Oh, yeah, no, that's why it's so prejudicial. When I watched him testify, it's... You know, it kind of crosses your mind. It's like, whoa, he needs to really be punished for that. And I know I'm here on this murder case, but I'm looking at what he did to this. So I do think the prejudicial effect might far outweigh the probative value. So, again, it wouldn't surprise me. I'm certain that's going to be one of the arguments by the defense, and I think it potentially will be very effective. So I just want to point that out in advance, what may happen on Monday.
Well, and it's interesting that, you know, Eric Bland was there, too. And, and you know, he was ready. We've heard him at the hearing that put him behind bars. Honestly, Alec Murdoch has been in prison for quite a while now. And this was
jail, technically, not prison.
Oh, sorry. Jail. State. Yeah.
There is a difference.
Sorry. He's in county jail, of course. But he these cases are why he's in shackles. I mean, he's not coming on his free will. He's being brought in every day from the jailhouse.
Shocking. And there's so much money, right? I mean, how much money does a person need? He's taking millions from this poor young man and his brother. We can talk about this later, but where is this money going anyhow?
That was another issue that we broached somewhat today. The money's going in and out as quick as it's coming in, a lot of it going to C.E. Smith, Curtis E. Smith, Curtis Edward Smith, Eddie Smith.
Aliases, lots and lots of aliases for Cousin Eddie.
Cousin Eddie is, I think, and we've heard it making its rounds today.
Sure.
Cousin Eddie's coming up on the stand real soon.
Yeah, he's on his way. And he's in jail, too. He's actually... In the same
he was moved. Yeah, he was moved to Lexington County.
In Lexington.
Yeah, wow. He was moved to Lexington County back several months ago. I asked about it at the time, and I don't remember quite what the answer was, but it's more or less the fact for his own safety. And,
that would make sense.
Well, so Eddie we actually did an interview with Eddie. Max was with me. And we got the call to go, and we had to go to an undisclosed location to do this interview with Eddie quite a while ago. And it was like literally not long after he had been arrested and being involved in the roadside botched suicide attempt.
Wow, that
from
must
Labor
have been,
Day.
That must have been something.
It was something. And he looked completely different. That was one thing I can say about him. And just to finish it off, I mean, he said... Alec was like a brother to me, but we have learned much more about that relationship. And I have a feeling as we could, you know, foreshadow what's going to happen next week. I think we should definitely be prepared to hear from Cousin Eddie coming up. That's going to be very important for the state to like bring this whole case home. Now, there was another thing that happened today as well. Once the jury got back in, we had an opportunity to hear from the firearms expert about the shell casings, and we've heard a lot about shell casings in this case, and the jury is trying to stay with them, I think. But let's play the clip and we'll tell you what we think.
If I understand it correctly, the items collected right by Maggie had been extracted, loaded into, extracted to, and ejected by the same firearm that identified that items were picked up by the side of the house?
Yes, sir, that is correct. It was determined that those items, and to include items 108, 113, 116, 117, and 122, also had those same matching mechanism marks, to conclude that they had been loaded into, extracted, and ejected from the same firearm as those at the crime scene around Margaret Murdoch's body, and those several recovered from the home.
So that was the evidence.
Yes, yes.
That the state was providing today, mm-hmm, about the shell casings, and to be super clear, shell casings that have the same marks on them that make them very identifiable to being cycled through one firearm, a firearm that we know was available, the type of firearm was available, this blackout rifle, on the property.
Yes, yes, and it matched the casings.
The casings that were
Maggie
found
Maggie Murdoch's body. And
from different time periods, too.
Yes, and I'd share this with our listeners and viewers, and I've been in lots of courtrooms prosecuting, and a firm also practices criminal defense. It was a moment when it was somewhat boring, I'd say, some of the testimony. Wouldn't you say he was going through? But when it became, when he testified that in his opinion, the casings near Maggie Murdoch's body, particularly the ones that matched by the residents, they matched the ones that had been cycled through, I saw visibly a number of jurors, a number of them, and was able to make eye contact. It really sank into them that this was hard evidence of the guilt of this defendant. Now, it's early. The defense doesn't have to put on a case, but they will. Mm-hmm. We haven't heard from them. So I do think we have a lot more information that we'll be hearing relative to whether or not the state's proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt. But I will say it was a moment today from the state standpoint in proving the unthinkable. And I want to get back to that because I do think that's a real issue the state has to address, because it is unthinkable to most humans.
Mm, unbelievable. What do you think, Drew?
I'm with Charlie. To his point, yes. I'm still trying to be open-minded a bit to the possibility of more than one person being involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, look, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to jump down the speculation rabbit hole here.
That's fair.
And let's think here. And this is where my mind has gone, Charlie. And I want you to tell me if this is unreasonable or not. Is there any chance that this prosecution, that this is an attempt to flush out other people and to really, really squeeze Alec to give out more information on potentially other bad things that he's involved in? Not to say that he wasn't involved with his wife and child's murders, but...
Well, that's an interesting... You know, under our procedure, actually, I forget the rule now, but I need to review that because it may be applicable to this case. Even after post-conviction, there may be a possibility of getting sentencing relief. Let me look at that rule. We can talk about that maybe next week. But
yeah,
even if the rule doesn't exist, the idea that you're proposing, because the state could, without this prosecution for murder, under life without parole procedures that we have, with the financial crimes that
he's going away.
He's got, I think the last count, I counted 900 years that he capable of being sentenced.
Yeah, and also on top of that, with if they did the prosecutions in a certain order, he would be ineligible for parole. So he'd be in there for life. So they knew they could do that. So the motivation to go through with this murder prosecution, I wouldn't necessarily discount that. I have a hard time actually thinking there would be that much forward thinking to want to squeeze him, because if he hasn't rolled, as they say, at this point, I don't think he's rolling ever. And so I just have to think overall. I don't want to discount your speculation or theory here, but I do think, just generally speaking, that the tone I'm getting is that no, we really think he did it alone, and all the evidence is going to point to him and him alone. I do think there's some timeline issues that we've talked about and probably we'll talk about in the future. So I would say overall, no, but hey, There have been so many surprises in this case. Yeah. Every day's been a surprise for me.
It's an interesting theory.
If I'm still putting that objective hat on and putting myself in the shoes of a juror, I'm really now wanting to know how they think he did it.
Yes.
He accomplished it. And we'll get
show
there.
Show us.
Yeah.
Right?
We're getting there. I think we're getting there.
Well, and we haven't even heard the defense's side. I mean, we don't even know how long the defense is going to go
so
on
true.
For. So
that's true. Yeah. And to be
they're
clear,
they're
going to
show us how he didn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And they don't have to put up a defense, but it's been very clear they're going to. I mean, they just have too many things going on where I'm confident they'll have lots of witnesses.
Well, one thing, and this keeps on running in my mind, is that Dick Harpootlian's already put it out there in his opening statement, the defense attorney for Alec, that he wants to take this whole jury on a field trip to Moselle so they can see how large this property is, how it would have been, because all of us are thinking if he was still on that property and he heard all those guns going off or smelled the gun smoke or whatever, you would have known immediately there was something horrific happening. Mm-hmm. We know how many bullets were fired.
Yeah, and that's actually a good point because he threw that out there, as I recall, an opening statement, right?
Sure.
And so if the state objects, it's going to look like the objection won't occur in front of the jury, but still, if they don't go out there, there could be some thought, wait a minute, the state's hiding something. So we'll see if they've got some agreement already, but my thought would be that if I'm prosecuting, I'd say, sure, let's go on out there, and which is not uncommon to have a scene visit.
A little bit of a go to the crime scene and walk it and see what it feels like. Mm-hmm. Boy, I would love to be there.
While that's all well and good, and it could have some value, I'm sure, it's hard to still escape what we agreed upon before we came in to this episode. The biggest story of the week coming out of this trial.
Oh, yes.
That video that so far blows up his alibi that I was not there, and yet here you are identified by two of Paul's best friends, like who considered you, Alec Murdoch, like a second dad, like a second family. We're always at his and 100% confident that your voice on that video putting you there about 5 minutes before the state says the murders happened.
That's right.
And that you still can't get past that. I think the circumstantial evidence is certainly becoming insurmountable at this point that he is somehow involved. Whether we take it for the fact that the shell casings, I'm going to be as clear as I can on stating this in case anybody else needs clarification. What we heard today from the state's firearms analysis expert is that individual and unique markings created by a certain gun were found on the shell casings by Maggie's body and on other places on that Murdoch property to a large extent proving that the murder weapon had been on that property at some point in the past.
Yes, that's a fair statement.
And that gun is missing. That gun is missing. They don't have it. They don't have the murder weapon. Where is it? Where did it go? There's proof now that it's been there. There's other little things that we've heard throughout the week that his alibi doesn't match up with the timings. And there was the little thing about, Maggie had left and gone to the doctor that morning. And, if we read Maggie's texts, she wasn't there at all. Alec wanted her to come home that day from the beach, and we hear that she likes staying at the beach. She didn't like staying at Moselle. It's
one
getting
thing
there.
After another.
Right.
It's so convoluted.
But the big one is the video.
Yes. Yeah, so let's play the video. So this to us was probably the biggest moment in the state's case this week.
Agreed.
Get back. Quit, Cash. Come. Quit. That's okay. Come here. It's not bad. Come here, Cash. Shit. Come here. Post it. Cash.
Hey, he's got a bird in his mouth.
Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
It's a guinea.
This is a chicken. Come here, Bubba.
Come here, Cash.
Come here, Bubba.
Cash. Quick.
Wow.
You hear Alec Murdoch's voice about four times on that video.
Wow. And, you know, to your point, it is, in the States has a circumstantial evidence case. And, of course, if I'm a juror, I'd like to have direct evidence. I'd like to have an eyewitness. But, of course, the eyewitnesses here are dead.
Right.
And so we don't have the murder weapons. Well, does that make it impossible to convict somebody of a double homicide? No. It's circumstantially can be proved. It's difficult.
Right,
typically, with circumstantial evidence cases,
from the extraction or from the actual device to the phone logs,
it can be done.
Call detail records provide.
Sorry.
We had a rogue video start playing. Max turned his head for 1 second and it betrayed him.
Back on track.
Charlie, what were you saying?
I was just saying the reality of where the case stands is these strands of the rope that we've talked about, that you can prove a circumstantial evidence case, and I think that a really good analogy is a rope. If you have a single strand of that rope, it's very, very weak. But you get 2, 3, 4, 5, and I'm counting strands here. What would you think? Maybe over 100 now?
Mm-hmm.
There's
and
a lot.
There are a lot of strands, and I think it's starting to be a pretty stout rope here.
Well, and I think what the state's done so well, as we've watched, it's very hard to explain chaos. And
right.
I feel like they're doing a very good job of explaining the chaotic nature of what was going on in every facet. We knew that it was chaotic just because it was a busy young family to some degree that was doing lots of things. But then you start seeing, as you start peeling back the layers, you see the chaos and how stressful that chaos really was, from the boat crash incident with Paul to, you know, they're building up to all of these truly.
Right. And the financial issues, he was stretched financially, and those financial documents today. He was not good with money, was he? It looked like to me he was in some bad investments and money was just flying out. But I still don't quite get where it all went, though.
Yeah, well, I think that's going to be next week. I think there's a lot to come next week, and it's going to play itself out. I mean, the defense is going to have a lot to tackle next. We did want to clear up one thing, and this was about the deleted calls on Alec Murdoch's phone. We were talking about it. Let's go ahead and play that clip that Max the one that just almost played a little while ago.
Compared the call logs from the extraction or from the actual device to the phone logs that I saw on the call detail records provided from Verizon. On the date in question on June 7th, I only saw two FaceTime calls on the phone extraction, and I saw a series of around 73 phone calls on the Verizon call detail record.
So I think last night we kind of glossed over that a little bit and maybe didn't give you an accurate timeline of what exactly happened, what exactly was being said right there. Those 73 missed calls weren't over a several day period. They were a single day.
Oh, is that right? I missed that. Yeah.
When they, there was, I think it, going back a day or two, there had been more testimony that they had pulled more days in a broader look. But the 73 missed calls were missing, according to our re-listen of it, the 73 missed calls were missing from the day of.
June 7th.
Yes. And Charlie, to your point about strands and circumstantial evidence, why are 73 missed calls missing from your phone?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Evidence of guilt, isn't it? Hiding evidence. So, yeah, it's...
Who was he calling? Why was he calling? Who was he trying to get a hold of?
And I know this is a little bit off topic, too, but I just can't leave today without talking about the bank, right? I mean, it looked like it was his personal piggy bank, right? I mean, who does that? And I guess Russell Lafitte must have been his key contact there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Lafitte, from what you've learned in when listening to the Russell Lafitte federal trial... I mean, this was a situation where they started and they didn't stop, and they realized that they could get away with doing
amazing.
That kind of work.
I mean, we heard the overdraft of roughly $350,000, and so Prosecutor Waters made the astute observation, must be the most generous overdraft policy, do you say in the world or in the country?
Mm-hmm. I think in the world, in the history,
history.
Is what he said. And yeah, and I think AUSA Emily Limehouse made that same point during the federal trial for Russell Lafitte. Mm-hmm.
And she's been here too, by the way.
Yeah. And I think Russell, his dad and his sister, not just Russell, but his dad and his sister potentially have a lot to answer for there. Because one of the most incredible things to come out of that Lafitte trial was the fact that when the rest of the bank's board of directors mm-hmm. and other members of that executive committee started asking questions and saying, hey, this doesn't look right, Russell Lafitte's dad got up in front of all of them and said, we've been giving him money. We're going to keep giving him money, like in no uncertain terms. And you have to wonder, did he know the full extent of what his son, Russell, had, according to a jury's conviction, been doing knowingly? And that was the overwhelming evidence.
Yes, yes. But the new CEO, I would say, that he testified well. He's the new one. And I think the prosecutor called him new sheriff in town. It looked mm-hmm. to me like he's going
to
right the bank there and wish them well going forward.
Trying to steady the ship a bit.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, we have wrapped up this week. We are going... Oh, do you have one more thing?
No, I just want to thank, want to thank everyone who has been tuning in, whether you're watching along Facebook, YouTube, abcnews4.com. That's our home website for us, WCIV-TV in Charleston, ABC News 4. We're putting all this stuff on video so you can watch along with our YouTube channel, our Facebook. We're streaming on Twitter tonight. We've done that a few nights in a row now. We've also got the podcast. This is how we started doing it, was just on the podcast. If you're looking for us, we'd appreciate it. We're really thrilled to see today we're looking at the Apple Podcast charts. We are in the top 50 true crime podcasts on Apple right now, which is just amazing for us.
Yeah.
So that's in large part to all of you listening. If you're watching and not listening, please go like and subscribe to us on our podcast feed.
Anywhere that you listen to podcasts, Spotify, Apple, go for it. We'll be there.
Max has on the video feed right now, he has the full screen graphic up that shows you what you're looking for as far as trying to match up with the actual name of the show. It is Unsolved South Carolina, The Murdoch Murders, Money, and Mystery. That is the name of the podcast, Unsolved South Carolina, The Murdoch Murders, Money, and Mystery. If you can search either of those two things, if you're looking for us on the podcast itself, if you're watching and not subscribed to the podcast, please look for that. You'll look for this logo, the Unsolved South Carolina logo. That's what we're branded under. We do several other podcasts. We have one for the Brittany Drexel case.
That's right. It's running right now. We just dropped a new one last week.
The most infamous missing person case in South Carolina of the 21st century so far. Max is trying to attack me right now as I'm speaking. He's trying to wrap me up aggressively.
I know. This is why you've got to get a camera on Max and Drew. That is going to be my goal next week. It's going to happen. I know it's going to happen. But you got to see our setup over there too, because we're all working hard today. But I want to send y'all home with the thought that this is far from over. We're going to be following every step. We want you to follow along with us. We've got it looks like we're going to have quite a bit more testimony. So we'll see you soon. We're signing off for this week. I'm Ann Emerson. Charlie Condon, Drew Tripp, Max Harrison, thank you so much for being part of our day.
Max, who did this music? This is Max.
This is Max. What would we be without our music?